tweet at TodaySOR.
After nearly 40 years with one of the world's biggest multinational companies, Unilever, Niall Fitzgerald is one of the most experienced Irish business leaders of his generation. He left these shores in 1971 and his career saw him work in Britain, where he now lives, in continental Europe and the United States, and also in South Africa. Tonight he's being honoured by business and finance media at an event in Dublin, and he's with me now in studio. Thanks indeed for coming in.
Thank you, Sean.
Rather fortuitous in one sense to have you in studio today, Niall Fitzgerald. I'm looking at the Financial Times front page and it says, UK braced for Unilever snub as Netherlands leads race for HQ, which I suppose brings us neatly to one of the topics du jour, is the whole question of Brexit and what it means. But do you think they're going to go, your former colleagues, will they go and settle in Rotterdam as their headquarters as opposed to having it in London?
As you might imagine, it's something that I really couldn't comment on because I'm not involved. They will take whatever decision is appropriate. I think the reality is that if you look back, Unilever grew up in the Netherlands and in the UK. It's a dual company. But actually, both countries, in terms of where their business is, are now less and less important. There's only 5% of Unilever's business in the UK. So historically, while it was a good place to have a headquarters, whether it is in the future, you know, circumstances change. And Brexit doesn't help in that respect, because if it was to be outside the European Union, as it clearly will be, that adds a new dimension to the question as to whether this is the best place to continue to have the headquarters. But I'm not involved in the decision.
I accept that, yeah. You haven't been involved since 2004, but nonetheless, that would be of interest to you. And you're somebody who was, you know, unequivocally of the view, and I think remains so, that Brexit is a bad idea for Britain as well as for Europe.
Absolutely. I have not the slightest idea. It's about the worst idea that they've ever come up with. And it came about, I mean, the referendum result, in my view, came about because politicians on both sides were not taking care of what was happening in terms of the economy and how the benefits of the economy were being spread in the United Kingdom. So there were a lot of disenchanted people. And when a referendum came up, the UK has no tradition of referendums. And it was seen by many people, I think, as an opportunity just to kick the government. The fact that it had such such implications and indeed was irreversible, or at least in theory irreversible, was probably people didn't think about it. It was just an opportunity to say, we're unhappy.
Indeed. But they're having, I think Mrs. May and her cabinet are having an away day today to try to plot their way ahead. Do you think that the divisions that are there are going to mean between the Remainers, or at least the people who are in favour of a soft Brexit and who accept that, you know, they're on the way out, and the people like Boris Johnson and others who say, look, this is a great opportunity, they'll be on their own, they can negotiate these great deals with the rest of the world unfettered by the minutiae of Brussels regulations?
Yeah, I'd like to know who they're going to negotiate with, but that you can't do within the European Union. I mean, for instance, the United States and China are often mentioned. Well, Germany does 4 or 5 times the amount of trade that Britain does with the US and China from within the European Union. So I'm not sure what's going to change outside. They just actually happen to be better and have better products. So I think this is a myth. Trade negotiations are all about power. And if you diminish yourself by being a smaller potential partner, then you have less power. And I think they will suffer as a consequence.
How do you think the Irish government's been handling things?
I think, well, it's very difficult, obviously, and the Northern Ireland issue makes it even more complicated here. But I think they have been restrained, yet making their point of view well known. But it's now coming to the point where once it is what Britain actually wants to negotiate is clear, and it's not clear to anybody at this stage, it may be after today's cabinet discussion, then I think Ireland will probably have to take a higher profile in saying, well, this works for us and this part doesn't work for us. But the island of Ireland issue is one which they have to keep a very close eye on, because commitments were made without it being clear to anybody how exactly those commitments could be honoured.
In other words, how can you have full regulatory alignment on this island and at the same time not have Britain part of, say, a customs union, not to mention the single market?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we probably have to help our British colleagues get off the where they've got caught in this issue about a or the customs union. Let's stop talking about that and say, let's have a new customs partnership. It actually might end up being the same thing, but it starts from a different point of view.
And so in other words, we effectively don't change things a whole lot.
Essentially.
But allow them, I won't say the pretense, but at least to maintain that they have.
We negotiated something which was met our needs. The fact that it happens to be 90% similar to what was already there, you can put aside. There's a little bit of face-saving required here as well.
Now, I mentioned about your role in Unilever, a company which I think employs some 169,000 people and is all over the world. The kind of products that are in everyday use, names like Knorr, Lipton's, my favourite one I suppose would be Magnum as an ice cream. There's products like Dove, Sunsilk and all the rest of it, Vaseline, Domestos, Omo. But we're at a time where I suppose there's an increasing concern about the environment and the use of packaging and plastics. Now, if you go onto the Unilever website, as I did last night, there's a lot of fine language about reducing packaging and having things that are either recyclable or reusable or biodegradable. And at the same time, you are somebody who talked about, and again, you were one of the, I don't know if it's still the case, that Unilever is the biggest provider of frozen seafood or fish products in the world. There's a kind of a contradiction there, isn't there, environmentally?
Well, there is, and that's why Unilever has, if you have looked at the website, you'll have seen it doesn't talk about its strategic plan. It talks about the sustainable living plan, which is about how do you do business in a way which is sustainable and indeed reduce your environmental footprint. Now, you can't do that overnight, but if you have a plan to get there over a 5 or 10 year period, then step by step you can do it. You're common in frozen foods. Unilever isn't in frozen foods anymore. But when it was, and that was in my time, we took the initiative with the Worldwide Fund for Nature of establishing what became known as the Marine Stewardship Council, which was to certify that fishing came from sustainable sources. And indeed, the way that I convinced people internally that this was the right thing to do is to say, we were the biggest suppliers of fish, but fish fingers. I said, if you have no fish, you have no fish fingers. So it is in our self-interest to make sure that they're sustainable. The plastic issue is a very complicated one, but indeed all manufacturers have to take a responsibility to find increasingly ways in which at the very least, it's recyclable, but actually, ideally, reduce progressively the use of plastic.
I don't know if you are familiar with the survey or the study that was published just a few days ago here by scientists at NUI Galway. They, working with the Marine Institute, they had done some research. Deep water fish in some of the most remote parts of the Atlantic, showing that there were microplastics present in almost 75% of those fish.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is something which is not in the short term reversible, may not even be in the long term reversible, but we have to stop loading the oceans with even more. Now, a lot of these plastics, it's not, in a sense, the obvious, it's not the bottles and the packs that you see floating around the sea. Much of this plastic comes from the clothes we're wearing. Mm-hmm. And every time you wash those clothes, micro elements of plastic go into the water system. So it's a wider and more complicated issue than simply saying we're not going to have plastic packaging.
Right. And talking about clothing, I think another story that you would be familiar with, again, going back to the Financial Times, this is going way back, but I was reading about it in Ian Hyland's interview with you in that great big tome he published about the history of Irish business. You found yourself there on page one of the FT, and there was a picture of a washing line.
There was, and the headline was "The Man Who Shredded Your Underpants."
That was you?
That was me. That was, we launched a product with a wonderful new element in it, which had the capacity to clean clothes better than anything that had ever been seen. Unfortunately, if it wasn't used in exactly the right spec, it cleaned so well that it cleaned away the clothes as well. And that was something which was done for all the right intentions. I mean, the product was launched with the right intentions without actually fully understanding some of the side effects. And I was personally responsible for Unilever's largest marketing disaster.
And I think you said as well that one of the reasons it didn't come to your attention earlier was because the way people who were working closely with you had their laundry dealt with.
Well, indeed. I mean, it was only when at one very pivotal meeting I said to everyone on the table, so can we all raise our hands, those who wash our own clothes, including myself? And I said, I certainly don't. And there was nobody in the room. And I have to say, in this room, there was all of the marketing and research brains of Unilever on the detergent side. So at that moment, I thought, wait a minute, we're missing here. There isn't a customer in the room.
And hence, that was the reason for the demise of, was it Personal Power?
Personal Power, yeah. It wasn't the demise of the brand. I mean, it recovered subsequently, but it was the demise of that particular variety. And it was, and I can say it now with a smile on my face, it was pretty grim at the time, but it was the richest learning experience that I've ever had. And indeed, my own chairman at the time, because I had assumed, of course, that most people thought that I was going to be the next CEO, although it wasn't public knowledge. So I went to the board and said, well, clearly I now have to go. I'm responsible for this. I'm entirely accountable. Although I'd like to stay for a little while to help my team recover, because they're a wonderful group of people. And he said to me, but why are you, what's this suggestion about going? I said, well, clearly I have to take responsibility for this. He said, look, young man, he said, I think it's the last time somebody ever said to me, young man, he said, look, young man, we've just invested £350 million in your education. If you think you're going to take that somewhere else, forget it.
It cost £350 million.
£350 million.
So how did you go about applying the lessons that you got from that very expensive
widely
lesson?
Widely, and I'm applying them to this day. The core lesson in it is that if you ever move away from being your own customer, then you are more than likely going to do things which are not in the interest of that customer. And and that runs through in Unilever, not just in terms of our products, in terms of our approach to the environment, just to link the two points, because as I used to explain to young people in Unilever, remember, this is a branded business. We sell to consumers. The consumers are citizens. They live in communities. And unless we are responsible and engaged members of those communities, we will lose their respect as citizens, and eventually we lose their support as customers.
One of the assignments you took on, I suspect with some hesitancy, was to run the show for Unilever in South Africa.
Mm.
How did that come about? And you did look. You did apply certain T's and C's when you agreed to take it on.
Yeah, I did. It came about so my chairman one day asked me if I'd do it, and I looked at him and I said, this has to be a very bad joke. You know my views on apartheid and everything to do with it. How could you possibly ask me to contemplate this? And he said, that's exactly why we're asking you to contemplate it, because we think we can be a better force for change from within, providing we can run our business according to our principles, which in many cases would be contrary to the law of the land. So having thought about it, I said, OK, I'll take it on, providing I have your assurance that if at any stage I ring and say I can't take this anymore, it's all too difficult and personally problematic, that I can come out. And he said yes. And then I think it was 5 years later when they said we'd like you to do something else. I said, it's too soon. We're making too much progress. When I went there, I went to see the then president, Peter Porter. I have to say, one of the most unpleasant people I've ever encountered in my life. And I told him that my brief was to run business in accordance to our principles, which would be different from the law of the land. He said, well, we will put you in prison. And I said, well, that's your choice. If you do, it has consequences. So we did run it according to our principles, which did breach the law, and I was never put in prison. And I think that was an important example to everybody else. But at the same time, we did it by also running a very successful business.
That had to do where you broke the law. It had to do, I think, with the construction, was it of toilets?
Yeah, we broke the law all over the place. I mean, whether it was in housing and so, but there is a particular story about what's called ablution blocks, where they had to be segregated, black, white, Indian and coloured, male and female. We were building a new factory. And I said, we will not segregate them. There will be male and female, obviously, and you can have them gold-plated. As far as I'm concerned, they can be the finest facilities in the world, but they won't be segregated on racial lines. And we opened it, and then the Minister of Industry, we invited him to come and open the factory, and I invited him to see the toilet facilities. He didn't remark on them. But some months later, a gentleman from the Department of the Interior, Mr. van der Merwe, came to see me, and he said, you're breaking the law with your ablution facilities. And he said, you have a problem. I said, no, I don't have any problem. You have a problem, because you now have to decide what to do, because I'm not doing anything. That was the last we ever heard of it.
You found, I think, Nelson Mandela altogether more agreeable as a head of government or head of state to deal with. And you actually took on some work on his behalf in Britain.
Yes, I chaired his legacy trust for 5 years, which was the single greatest honour I've ever had. When he asked me to do it, it was, of course, a nanosecond decision to say yes. And I learned more from him than I have from any other single human being, with the possible exception of my mother.
What stands out?
His humility. His ability to immediately identify in any gathering, in any room, big or small, with the what conventionally you might say is the least important person there, And immediately go to them and make them feel so much better. I mean, I'll tell you quickly a little story. He came to my home, and I had then two people who were working in the garden, two young men. And I said to them about half an hour before, because I couldn't tell them for security reasons, I said, Mr. Mandela's coming here. No, I said, from the moment I've told you, you can't leave the premises. If you do, somebody might shoot you. I said, but if you stand here, he'll be passing by. So he did, and he stopped as he came to them, and he looked at them, and he said, are you the two boys who have built, who have made this beautiful garden? And in that moment, they grew 20 feet tall. And my guess is on their deathbeds, that'll be the thing they'll remember. He had that facility to make everybody feel great.
And from your mother, you learned?
From my mother, I learned many, 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 many things, but perhaps in a business context, the most important thing, she said, if you ever want to succeed in whatever you do, she said, remember, your only responsibility is to find the best in other people.
A very good piece of advice. The concern that you had in helping the Mandela Foundation, I mean, you've always been concerned with Africa, and you've made the point that, look, we have to help Africa if only to save Europe. And that was never more a valid argument than it is now.
Yeah, it is. And if we had done more, and we can still do so, of course, to help Africa on the ground to create the opportunities in Africa, then the issue we currently have with people desperate to find opportunities just to earn a simple living, and if they can't do it in their country in Africa, they come elsewhere. And then we end up with a different kind of problem. If we'd been spending more time, more resource, more focus, more priority on helping African countries to help themselves, not just to give them aid, but to help them to help themselves by building their industry and their employment opportunities, then I think that problem will be much less. We can still do that.
Yeah, but there have been all sorts of initiatives like the End of Poverty One, the idea that people would be helped, you know, to build democracies. But the latest news from South Africa, okay, things are better that Ramaphosa has taken over from Jacob Zuma. But it hasn't exactly been a quarter of a century since the first free democratic elections of unalloyed success or prosperity. And, you know, the millions and millions of black people remain in poverty.
Yeah, I mean, that is a particular South African problem. They have suffered because, frankly, they had a corrupt regime in power for the last 8-9 years. Everybody is very hopeful. I know Cyril Ramaphosa personally, and I'm certainly very hopeful that he will deal with this complex and challenging issue, but he will deal with it with great integrity and determination.
But the great hope was, I suppose, that South Africa would be the driver of improvements.
It was,
certainly in sub-Saharan Africa.
One has to take it on a broader front. I mean, if you actually look at the facts are there are more democratic institutions and there have been more free elections in Africa today than there ever was in the past 20 or 30 years. So you have to look at the whole. The African birth rate, of course, is very high, so the numbers of people are growing very rapidly. I, at one stage, at the request of the then British government, chaired something called the Investment Climate Facility for Africa, which was providing funds not in the conventional aid sense, but to help them build their own infrastructure, their port facilities, their how to handle customs, their educational infrastructure. And that's the way to do it. Do it on the, give them the tools. It's, you know, it's the old cliche is don't give a man a fish, but help him to learn how to fish for himself.
Give him the rod. Among the other things you've taken on, you know, you were, I think, chair of Reuters for a time, and also of the British Museum. And then you were knighted by Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth about 15 years ago or so. But you never really made a whole lot of that, did you?
No, I mean, I was...
You don't call yourself
Sir
Niall Fitzgerald.
No, I don't, not at all. I mean, I took it on an honorary basis. There was a suggestion at the time, would I like to take on dual citizenship? And I said, no, I'm perfectly happy with the citizenship I have. I'm Irish and I'm never going to change from that. But just in terms of common courtesy, if they want to recognize it was work I was doing for Global Britain, basically, which is slightly ironic in the current circumstances. I said, of course I'll do it. I'll accept the honor very gratefully, but I don't want to use the title in any way, but I'll certainly accept the honor. Thank you.
Right. And do you have much that you're doing now at the moment? I mean, it's a while since you were with Unilever.
If you ask my wife, she'd just say I'm doing more than I've ever done in my life. Quite a lot of what I do is in education. I chair something called the Leverhulme Trust, which is the largest sponsor of academic research, private sponsor of academic research in the UK outside of medicine. I chair the Smurfit School here. I chair a school board. I chair the commercial board of Munster.
That would be rugby.
It would be rugby indeed. And I am conscious of talking about this in Leinster, but that is one of the more fun, but also one of the more challenging, because Munster's a great club. But the world has become, and that's in the rugby world, very professional, and we have to keep pace with that and indeed get ahead of it. And we will, and are.
And I mean, the Irish provinces, they've had great success in recent years. Do you think they're going to be able to sustain that, given the kind of money that's available, say, in France and in Britain?
I think it's challenging, but I think we have to do it in a different way. And I think one of the things which has actually worked well for both the provinces and for Ireland is the fact that there is a serious restriction on the number of foreign players you can have playing in a province. You can't have more than four. And that means that there are channels to feed through and develop bright, smart, able Irish rugby players through the academies. So forcing your back on breeding your own, I think, is an extremely good thing. Now, if you take in contrast with, say, France, who've gone the other way, I can still remember, I think it was about 3 years ago, when the Toulon team that ran onto the field for the final of the European Cup did not have one French player on the team. At that moment, I said, French rugby is now in serious trouble. It's similar in many ways to the Premier League in the UK on soccer, where it's a great league for the clubs, but it does nothing for the national team.
You would hardly presume to tell Joe Schmidt how to do his job, but what do you think of the idea that only Irish-based players really would be considered for selection for the national team?
I think I can understand where it comes from. However, I think it's not sustainable in the long term. And I think there's a different way to tackle it, which is to say that those players who want to play outside Ireland should make sure that in their contract there are release clauses which allow them for the defined periods of Irish training camps. And I think once you have that, because that's what he's concerned about, how do you get players together?
You mentioned your role as chair of the Smurfit Business School. You regard education as something that we could do more with by way of exporting it.
Yeah, I think there's a huge opportunity for Ireland now in education, not just by exporting, but by bringing more people in. Both the UK and the US, which used to be where people aspired to go from other parts of the world, are now much less welcoming of students from abroad, whereas Ireland is welcoming, very welcoming indeed, and it's a very nice place to be. But we have to then invest in not just the infrastructure of our universities, but in the talent in the universities, the academics, the researchers. And indeed, I was speaking on a panel this morning with the Taoiseach and made the point very forcefully that this is an opportunity, but you don't get the opportunity, won't come to fruition unless we invest now, and significantly so.
Is this an opportunity thrown up by Brexit primarily?
It is accentuated by Brexit, but I think it's a much wider one.
One other question that I intended asking you earlier, but I skipped over. The corporation tax rate, the 12.5%, how important do you think that is, and do you think we can hang on to it?
I think it's important. I don't think it necessarily drives investment. I mean, if I go back to my own business decisions, I never took a decision simply based on the tax rate. The fundamentals had to be right. And then the very last thing I would look at was there a tax benefit? So I think it's important that the margin, will we sustain it? I think there's a good chance. I mean, the drive elsewhere is actually to have tax rates come down. And you see what's just happened in the United States. We're driving the tax rate down below 20%.
Finally, you lost a very good friend recently.
I did.
Peter Sutherland.
I did. Peter was a wonderful person whose contribution, not just to Ireland but to the world, I think was quite profound and unique. And he's a great loss to his family, obviously, to his friends. But he's also a loss in terms of the humanity that he represented. And there are not enough voices who say the sorts of brave, courageous things that Peter used to say.
Niall Fitzgerald, pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for coming to studio.
Thank you, Sean.
Today with Sean O'Rourke on RTE Radio 1.